She was an author, an educator, and a tireless activist for Indigenous justice in the 19th and 20th centuries. She opposed the separation of Aboriginal children from their parents. She argued for Aboriginal rights to traditional lands long before it became well known as a cause. Citizenship rights, equal pay, access to pensions, they all received Mary's attention. And yet she's virtually unknown. The Melbourne-based historian Sue Taff is determined to change this. She's written the first full-length biography of this remarkable woman who seems to have established, above all, very strong friendships with some Indigenous people. Sue, welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you very much, Geraldine.
Is that a fair comment as one of the driving forces behind Mary's commitment?
Absolutely, yes. It began, I think, when she was a child. She had a nursemaid called Wyma, who was on her father's northwestern Queensland property at Lammermoor. And this woman, who had, you know, grown up as a traditional Dalabara woman, came into Mary's life when she was about three and looked after her till she was about five, not on that station, but down at Tinterfield. And that had quite an effect on Mary. Later in her life, she lived on the eastern goldfields of Western Australia, where, yes, the children that she taught there became very much like her family. And she worked and looked after them and loved them and assisted them and their children and grandchildren for the next 20 years.
She didn't have children of her own, did she?
No, she didn't. No, she suffered from diabetes. That wasn't actually discovered until her husband had died. So that was the reason that she was not able to conceive. It was she had diabetes in the pre-insulin time. So no, she had no children, and she was actually also sort of separated from her own family. And when her husband died, her husband was much older than her, when he died, she really decided that she needed to return to Australia. She always described herself as an English woman. She lived much of her early life in England. She came to the West Coast because she'd heard that life was pretty tough for Aboriginal people in the West in the 1920s, and she'd read of some of the things that had happened, a massacre at Forest River. And so she came to learn for herself what life was like for Aboriginal people in that part of Australia and to see what she could do, I think, to redress wrongs that she saw.
I noticed that it was launched in Melbourne by Jackie Huggins, who's a very formidable Indigenous representative. So yes. I take it that Indigenous people know about her. But how did you find Mary and what inspired you to write about her?
Well, really, it sort of happened through an earlier book that I wrote, which is called Black and White Together. That was the history of the Federal Council for the Advancement of Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders. That body was responsible, among other things, for establishing land rights campaigns in the late 1960s, for the long run-up to the 1967 referendum, and for the equal wages campaigns. And when I interviewed those people, oh, more than 20 years ago, they would speak about this amazing woman, Mary Montgomery Bennett. And one of those people, Dr. Barry Christophers, who's still alive today, said she was really like our spiritual mother because she was so far-sighted and she had such a humanity, a genuine care and concern, an intelligent care and concern for the people that she was assisting to help, both as individuals and to get structural change in the society.
Yes, look, we could go through her whole story, I suppose. Her father, a Scots pastoralist, a mother, a London artist. They move back and forward between Australia and England, a breathtaking number of times, as a matter of fact. But I'm more intrigued, I suppose, by what drove her to develop this big philosophy about the rights of Indigenous people, and particularly around education.
Yeah, I think that's a really sort of hard one for any biographer, I suppose. You know, you try to make sense of another person's life with the scraps that you have, aware that you only know what's been written or what's been told. But it seemed to me that she never had to work for a living. So she was wealthy because her father did so well as a pastoralist. And his wealth came, and she recognised this, although she was conflicted in the recognition.
He was very much a post-Enlightenment man, wasn't he? He had very sort of good, you know, gentle, fair attitudes to the surrounding Indigenous people.
Yes, that's right. And he was very intelligent. So he was interested in their culture and their language. And he also, of course, recognised he was a Scot and he was keen on making the most out of his money. So he was aware of the fact that if he had an accommodation with the Dalabara people, they could stay on what was their traditional land, and he would ask them to work for him. And so basically his wealth came in part from the fact that he had an unpaid workforce for probably at least 20 years. Mm. And I think Mary was aware of that. And I think when she began writing the biography of her father, Christison of Lammermoor, and started reading about the stories of the frontier wars in Queensland, but when she came to realise...
So he wasn't typical? Those attitudes weren't typical?
No. He was unusual in that he had the intelligence, the confidence, and the interest in other people to work out how to bridge that huge, huge cultural gap, because he was probably the first white man that many of those Dullabarra people saw.
Now, I've just got this little sidebar, the very interesting, because we're telling her story, there's all sorts of insights into attitudes to Australia, but there is one remarkable account of Mary writing about the nature of the people who were passing through at the time in the area of Torrens Creek. And this is one particular story of the travelling party being stopped. And this just gives you a feeling of, this is in the 1860s. Three starving old women appeared, and Barney, who was actually the Dullabarra right-hand man of Mr. Christensen, Barney stood with bowed head waiting and didn't speak or move, for he recognised the remnant of an allied tribe. The unhappy blacks of the Cape River dispersed in the inhospitable sandstone desert. The scarecrow wretches began a low sobbing that grew into a wail, wild, despairing, the unavailing crying of a murdered race. In the extremity of grief, they stretched their wasted arms to the unregarding heavens that burned on steadily like the end of the world.
That's very powerful, isn't it?
My goodness.
So that
formed her too.
Yes, that's right. So, of course, there was gold. Gold was discovered in the Cape River. And you can imagine the rapidity with which a traditional people's lives was just turned upside down. And that situation was replicated when she went to the eastern goldfields of Western Australia. Of course, she was seeing the same thing. Just, she was arriving there in 1930. It was only 40 years since Paddy Hannon had discovered gold. And so she was seeing that first generation of people whose lives had been shattered by white men digging for gold.
Then began this amazing commitment, which I hope we'll get a chance to talk about, in terms of her very advanced and full of expectations teaching of Aboriginal children, but she didn't take them away from their parents. But what do you think really was an underlying drive? I've read that there was almost what was described as an imperialistic humanism really guided her. But between the wars, that's been one version I've read. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I suppose I do. So I've interviewed her former pupils in Kalgoorlie and Leonora and Laverton, and they would say, yes, well, the day would begin with God Save the King. And then each class would begin with a student reciting a prayer. One of the ladies told me that you got into trouble if you muddled up the cheese knife with the butter knife.
So she was quite a sort of blue stocking too.
Yeah, she was. She was realising, I think, she knew at that time in the 1930s that the only future for these children was to gain the confidence and the education in the white mainstream society so that they could then make their way, so that they were then able to hang on to what they wanted to of their own culture, but hold up their heads and find work and find a place in the mainstream culture. So she was determined to give them really the best education that she could.
And here's something that one of her students wrote after Mary died in 1961. To us children, she was awesome. Of slim build and erect stature, she only needed to look over her steel-rimmed spectacles to make us quake. She was not a lady with whom you could mess around. Yes. However, that was only one side of her. Her pupils saw the other side of her, but the government never did. She really clashed with government, did she?
Oh, she did. She did. So at the time in the 1930s, there was no government body in Western Australia responsible for Aboriginal education. So she was teaching the children of the eastern goldfields. Some of them had white fathers who'd racked off and not accepted responsibility for their children, and some of them were of the full descent. And she had them all in the classroom of all ages. At the back of the classroom were sometimes the still tribally living people, watching what was going on, watching the chalk marks on the board with a child writing, "Jimmy, jump on the desk," and Jimmy then enacting that sentence. So she was educating them in that way. But for those children, it was really important for them to be able to gain an education in the mainstream, but still be loved and respected for who they were.
Tell us, Sue, if you would, about the paper she wrote in 1933 on the Aboriginal mother and the effect it had on the Native Affairs Administration in Western Australia, because she was really quite obsessed with the women as mothers and wives, both the way they were presented in the white world, but also in their own world.
Yes, well, she really caused a bit of a shock in Perth society when she sort of stated sort of blatantly that sex slavery existed in the north of the country and that Aboriginal men were prostituting their superfluous wives to white men. And she described that, you know, quite sort of directly as the culture of the country. She did this at the British Empire League conference in London before she left. And at that conference were some women who would have been the wives of pastoralists. So she was not popular with the establishment at all, but she called it as it was. And she wasn't really, I suppose, politically very adept in a way because she was so direct. But the other thing I wanted to sort of say, I've just remembered, I forgot it before, about education. So because she wasn't allowed to be teaching the children of full descent, when the inspectors came in the early 1940s, the kids had to be sent out to hide in the bush because they weren't allowed to be there. And when Neville actually found out that she was teaching children of the full descent, then there was a full-on row with Schenck, who was the director of the mission, and he was told that they had to leave. They had to go back to living tribally.
So do you know, have you really explored whether her teaching methods did produce the goods? Did she equip people to take their place in the wider world or not?
Well, she absolutely did. Sadie Canning was the director of nursing at Leonora Hospital. May O'Brien became director of Aboriginal education in Western Australia and a children's author. Dora Cottrell, a lovely woman who lives in Leonora, was a kindergarten teacher. So the women in particular seem to go very well, but also many of the people that I've taught who didn't gain professional positions, but women that I've met in Kalgoorlie have had great regard for her and have obviously sort of found their way in society and have, you know, earned a living and formed families, and life has been quite, you know, okay for them.
I think she was
remarkably good.
Did she feel she'd succeeded, or did she feel quite crushed by the time she died because there was a heck of a lot more to do in 61?
Yes. Look, I think it's very interesting. She was both an activist and an educator. As an activist, she was quite sure about her ideas. She knew that human rights had to apply to everyone. As an educator, she was unsure. She was wondering, is she doing the right thing? Is this the right technique? Is that the right technique? But she was, for example, in the 1930s, exploring the idea of using film as a teaching technique, getting the kids to have a go at making little films. Quite sort of astonishing. And radio shows and things like that. So she was using Montessori methods, using play. So I think she was a great educator. But I suppose, like all teachers, you have to always be wondering, you know, am I really getting through to all the kids? What about that one up the back? Bit quiet, maybe it's not working for that child. So I think she was very effective as a teacher.
Was she ever reconciled with people like A.O. Neville, who was in charge of Native Affairs, it was as called?
Oh, no.
No.
Not at all.
And the authority. She remained a burr in their saddle, did she?
Absolutely. So they did not like each other at all. No.
Sue Taff, thank you very much indeed for bringing this woman to our attention.
Thank you, Geraldine.
And Sue's book, which I encourage you to read, is called A White Hot Flame. It was published earlier this month by Monash University Publishing.